Today is March the 7th, 2018. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the program is available on wbai.org/archive, prn.fm, and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM, 99.5 on the radio, and prn.fm on the internet each Wednesday, with essentially the same program. However, WBAI is in a membership drive tonight, and the personal computer show on WBAI has been preempted. Reminder that Daylight Savings Time starts on the second Sunday in March, which is this coming Sunday. But first, what do we have in the news? The iPhone X didn't sell as well as Wall Street had anticipated, but this is just a start. Apple stock has slipped in recent days following a flurry of analyst notes and news reports raising concerns about demand for the pricey iPhone X. The phones were too expensive to drive massive adoption. Consumers are keeping their phones longer because of their high cost. Not only has Apple's much-expected sales supercycle failed to happen, but there's now serious concern about the next quarter and its effect for the company's upcoming new iPhones. The iPhone X, or the iPhone X, was in many ways a huge gamble for Apple. The iPhone X didn't manage to usher in the largest refresh cycle in iPhone history, as many analysts had anticipated, even though the iPhone X remains the most popular model within Apple's iPhone lineup. There have been reports that Apple in recent weeks has reduced iPhone X orders due to lower than anticipated demand. Seeking to figure out why the iPhone X hasn't shattered sales record, Piper Jaffray and Google Consumer Surveys recently issued a research note detailing a survey of 1,500 existing iPhone owners. The most interesting aspect of the note centers on why iPhone owners haven't yet opted to upgrade to the iPhone X. It was released by Apple 3.0, which is a subscription publication. Interestingly, 44% of the respondents indicated that they didn't upgrade because the current model, well, it works fine. What were some of the other things that they responded to? They prefer a larger screen. That's 8% of them. Well, in the new models, it will be a larger screen. Another one is, my iPhone works fine, by 44%. Hey, if it's not broken, why fix it? Why replace it? Well, eventually at some point in time, these units need to be replaced. Making it a 2-year cycle for replacement is far too frequent, and that's a mistake by Apple. And then 17% said for other reasons. So when you say it's too expensive or for another reason, that's a good 48%, which means that Apple may have serious problems with future sales of the iPhone. Apple later this year will reportedly introduce 3 brand new iPhone models, one of which will feature a Gorangutan 6.5-inch OLED display. And more importantly, the Apple's 2018 iPhone lineup will include a more wallet-friendly device with an edgeless 6.1-inch LCD display. I can tell you why iPhone users haven't upgraded. When you say that a new model will be introduced by the end of the year, why am I spending my money now? The main sticking point has been price. Each 5.5-inch LCD screen used in the iPhone 8 Plus costs Apple $52, whereas the iPhone X 5.8-inch OLED display is $110. Those prices should go up in the near term as Apple sources larger screens for its upcoming nearly 6.5-inch model. While the $1,000 iPhone X has given potential customers pause for thought, the biggest driver behind this course is its OLED display, a display Apple plans to make substantially bigger with a 6.5-inch unit later this year. How expensive could this make the iPhone X Plus? Estimates suggest up to $1,400. Well, consequently, Apple's discovery that many customers are starting to think twice about paying over $1,000 for the iPhone X, and it couldn't come at a worse time. Apple is already locked into the next cycle with the iPhone X Plus production test already underway. The iPhone X Plus is going to cost more than any iPhone in history, just as customers start to say enough is enough. Meanwhile, those very same customers recently learned that legal pressures have pushed Apple into offering a year-long promotion where they can renew their existing iPhone's performance and restore original battery life for $29. That's a no-brainer. The iPhone X was supposed to be Apple's celebration for 10 remarkable years of iPhone success. The irony is, history may prove it was the moment the company went too far. Spectrum is finally bowing to pressure being exerted by cable cutting services. It's offering a streaming live TV service that costs less than their regular cable TV. Spectrum, which is owned by Charter Communications, has quietly started offering what is called Spectrum TV Choice to a select group of customers in the capital region for $21.99. By the way, the standard cost is $29.99. It's a difference of $8. That's really a very small difference in cost. People are looking for more than that. Spectrum TV Choice allows you to pick 10 channels from a menu of 65 channels. Spectrum appears to be appealing to its existing internet customers who are currently getting their live TV channels through a streaming service. Charter spokesman said, "We continue to test and launch new traditional and stream video products to better serve the customer demand for more choice. We believe non-video, internet-only customers are interested in a smaller, lower-priced bundle. We want to meet the needs of all our customers." Spectrum has another streaming service called Spectrum TV Stream that has a set of 25 channels for the same price as the Spectrum TV Choice. However, the price difference is really, again, a very small amount. Both services can be viewed on smartphones, computers, and other wireless devices like tablets, but they can also be streamed on an internet-enabled video device. A traditional set-top box is not required. The Spectrum service requires that you use Spectrum Internet service, which is about $65 a month for existing customers and $45 for new customers. Spectrum direct mail offer to local customers say they will keep the introductory offer of the $21.99 for 2 years. Spectrum offers its streaming TV customers 5 premium channels like HBO and Showtime for $15 a month. I think they have to make it a bigger discount than all that. Cord cutting is where you actually eliminate the cost of a TV service, internet service, or phone service. And when they're talking about cord cutting, they're talking about something that's free. There are two things that many cord cutters are looking for when adding services to their current setup: live TV and minimal cost. Pluto TV, with over 100 channels of content from around the web, is available. This free service has become a favorite among cord cutters. Pluto TV has movies, TV shows, and live news. There are a lot of channels there. Pluto.tv is a free service that tries to mimic the cable box experience, only with internet channels. How Pluto TV works? On a basic level, using Pluto.tv is as simple as launching the app or heading to the website. The last channel you visited starts playing automatically. With a channel guide, you can scroll through on the bottom half of the screen, and Pluto's website and mobile apps lets you bookmark channels, so you can view your favorites without sifting through the full guide. The web and PC versions also include a save button, so you can go back and rewatch anything from Pluto.tv linear programming schedule. It's basically just a bookmark. It's sort of like a DVR. Much of the content comes from YouTube. You can tell from the watermarks at the start of each video, with contributions from smaller sites like Vimeo and Dailymotion. In some cases, Pluto.tv also makes direct content deals with media properties such as Maker Studio, Bloomberg TV, and Funny or Die. As for the programming lineups, Pluto.tv relies largely on in-house curators, though it also has some tools to help bring new videos to their attention. Roughly a third of Pluto's team is dedicated to putting channels together. With an average of 6 million monthly users, Pluto.tv has become one of the most popular content streaming apps available. That growth and popularity have made the service a magnet for both funders and advertisers. The company has raised an incredible amount of money along with attracting advertisers who air commercials during content streaming. Pluto.tv is a free service. Just sign up with an email address and start watching on the website, your TV, or with mobile app. After signing into Pluto, you can customize your viewing experience by going to the My Pluto section. A burger flipping robot named Flippy is now cooking up hamburgers at a fast food restaurant called Cali Burger in Pasadena. Your next fast food burger might be cooked by a robot. Flippy is a brand new burger flipping robot now cooking at a chain called Cali Burger, which serves up California-style burger and fries. The key to success in the restaurant industry is, of course, consistency. So anytime you go to a Cali Burger now, anywhere, you know that the patty will be cooked exactly the same. The robot was developed by a subsidiary called Miso Robotics. Before Flippy can get started, it needs a little human help. A co-worker puts raw patties on the grill. The kitchen of the future will always have people in it. Flippy uses thermostat imaging 3D and camera vision to sense when to flip and when to remove. It detects the temperature of the patty, the size of the patty, and the temperature of the grill surface. The device also learns through artificial intelligence. Basically, the more burgers that Flippy flips, the smarter it gets. Right now, cheese and toppings are added by a coworker. In addition to consistency and safety, Cali Burger says that the robot can cut down on costs. Less turnover means less time training new grill cooks. Miso Robotics says Flippy costs about $60,000, and Cali Burger is using Flippy in its Pasadena store with plans to expand the use of it at other locations soon. Questions were raised last year about whether FBI agents were actively recruiting technicians at Best Buy Geek Squad to search for illegal content on customers' devices. The existence of the Geek Squad informants was first revealed via the prosecution of a California doctor named Mark Rettenmeyer. After Rettenmeyer sent his computer to Geek Squad for repair in 2011, technicians working out of a Kentucky repair shop discovered thousands of images depicting child abuse on Rettenmeyer's device. Court filings later revealed that there were 8 FBI informants at Geek Squad City, and a number of them had received $500 to $1,000 payment in exchange for acting as confidential sources. It was unclear at the time how much Best Buy knew about the arrangement. However, documents recently acquired by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which last year sued the Justice Department under the Freedom of Information Act after the FBI denied the group access to records, showed that Best Buy has, at least at certain times, maintained a relationship with the feds, at one point hosting a meeting with the FBI Cyber Crimes Working Group at its Kentucky repair facility. When Geek Squad employees did locate child pornography on a customer's device, FBI agents would appear at the facility and the device would be seized, and in certain cases, a warrant was obtained to search the device. At first blush, it seems Geek Squad is providing a public service by helping the Bureau capture suspects trafficking in child pornography. Law enforcement paying retail employees to rifle through customers' data for illegal content raises a number of important Fourth Amendment issues. While Best Buy itself is authorized by customers to search their devices, the company's partnership with the FBI to some suggest that Best Buy is effectively acting as an arm of the Bureau, conducting searches that would otherwise require a probable cause warrant. The bounty the employees have been paid for locating illegal content may incentivize them to conduct searches that aren't necessary to complete repairs. EFF points out that the images found on Rettenmeyer's hard drive was in an unallocated space, which typically requires forensic software to find. In January 2017, Best Buy spokesman told the Washington Post that Best Buy and Geek Squad have no relationship with the FBI. Best Buy spokesman added, "Any circumstances in which an employee received payment from the FBI is the result of extremely poor individual judgment and not something that they tolerate, and is certainly not a part of their normal business behavior." Best Buy said that the Geek Squad repair employees have discovered what appears to be child pornography on customers' computers nearly 100 times a year, but that it's only discovered inadvertently when attempting to confirm that they have recovered lost customer data, and that they have a legal obligation to report these findings to law enforcement. The company said that they share this policy with customers in writing before we begin any repair. Other remarks made by Best Buy, however, appears to be contradicted by FBI records. The company said that its policies prohibits employees from doing anything other than what is necessary to solve the customer problem. Best Buy today declined to further clarify its statement. EFF said that the FBI has refused to confirm or deny whether it had similar arrangements with other businesses offering computer repair. We need an update. Cellebrite, the Israel-based forensic company that had been a key source for law enforcement in efforts to crack the security of mobile devices to recover evidence, has reportedly found a way to unlock Apple devices using all versions of the iOS operating system up to version 11.2.6, which is the most recent update. The capability is part of Cellebrite's Advanced Unlocking and Extraction Service, a lab-based service the company provides to law enforcement and agencies. It's not a software product. It is software, though. Experts suggest that Cellebrite's Advanced Unlocking Service may have found a way to bypass the limits on the PIN or password entry enforced by interfering with the code that counts the number of failed attempts, allowing the company's lab to launch a brute force attack to try to discover the passcode without fear of the device erasing its cryptographic key and rendering the phone unreadable. A Cellebrite spokesperson confirmed the claim. Cellebrite can retrieve, without needing to root or jailbreak the device, the full file system to recover downloaded emails, third-party application data, geolocation data, and system logs. Agencies can provide the device already unlocked, furnish the known passcode, or use Cellebrite's advanced unlocking services to unlock the device. Cellebrite is not revealing the nature of the advanced unlocking services approach. Cellebrite's attack method may be blocked, however, by upcoming iOS updates 11.3 or maybe higher. That leaves us to think that Cellebrite have a power timing attack that lets them bypass arbitrary delays and avoid device lockouts. That method would rely on specific characteristics of the software, which explains how Apple could patch what appears to be a hardware issue. Regardless of the approach, Cellebrite's method almost certainly is dependent on a brute force attack to discover the PIN. The long and short of it is that your passcode is required to unlock your phone. Cellebrite cannot magically discover your passcode. They can bypass all counters and lockouts, but at the end of the day, they need to brute force your passcode. Tonight we have feature segments on wearable and health technologies with Dr. Alfred Poor. He's going to be covering deep learning, artificial intelligence predicts heart disease from retina scans. He will also cover inexpensive sensors that use graphene. And finally, he'll talk about smart glasses helping assess effect of head impacts. From the Tech Corner, Joe and I will be talking about first the fake news, now we have fake videos, and now we also have fake audios. Can you spot a fake video? Is there any way you can identify a fake video? Now, what about detecting edited audio? And on the home automation front, by Marty Winston, he's going to talk about how he pinpoints temperature control through an array in each room. Quite interesting.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
Some of the hot topics today are artificial intelligence, deep learning, big data, and there's a lot of hype about a bunch of these topics, but the fact is there's really some solid, helpful stuff that's going on. And one of the places this is happening is Google, which is probably not a surprise because they do a lot of work with big data and artificial intelligence. Well, you may not be aware of the fact that they are using a lot of these tools to solve healthcare problems. They do this largely through some of the spinoffs off of Alphabet, which is the parent company of Google. But the AI labs have been working on a bunch of projects. In the past, we've reported about how they're using artificial intelligence to analyze medical images, such as MRIs and x-rays, to diagnose cancer. But now they have new research that they've reported on. You know, they say that the eyes are the windows of the soul. Well, it turns out they're also the windows of heart disease. What they did was they took about 250,000 retina images, photographs of the back of the eyeball, and set a deep learning artificial intelligence system loose on it to figure out what it could. And they gave it other information about the patients and their health history. And the system was able to develop its own rules for identifying heart disease. Now, this is pretty impressive, but it's even more surprising when you hear what this could do. After testing and developing this learning system, the researchers were able to present two retina scans to the system, and it was able to pick out which patient was going to have a heart attack within the next 5 years. And it was able to do this with 70% accuracy. So it can tell the future probably as well or better than most doctors can simply by looking at the scan of an eyeball. It could do more than that. It was 71% accurate at identifying which images were from somebody who smoked. And perhaps the most amazing thing about this was it was able to predict the blood pressure of the patient just by looking at that static image of their retina. It was able to predict their blood pressure within 11 millimeters of mercury, which is pretty impressive. And then you have to realize that it was doing this not just for patients with high blood pressure, but it was also accurately predicting it for patients with normal blood pressure. So this is pretty impressive stuff. Deep learning, big data, this is why all this collecting of health records and biometric data about patients is so important, because it's going to help us be able to identify problems long before there are any symptoms that we can notice. Got a number two pencil handy? It's one of the most common writing tools that we've got around these days. And if you've got one, you're looking at the working material for what may be the most inexpensive and most useful wearable sensors that we would have available. The graphite that's in a pencil is similar to the graphene, graphene being the one atom thick sheets of carbon. Graphene is a wonder material in itself. It's strong, it's flexible, it conducts electricity, it's transparent. I mean, there's a whole lot of things about it. But a team of physicists in England have found a way to use ordinary graphene to create a very low-cost, highly effective sensor. They create a mixture of oil and graphene and a little bit of water, and they put it in a tube, and the mixture will conduct electricity. Now, when you bend the tube, it changes the electrical characteristics of the mixture, and this can be measured, and it changes predictably, so it can be used as a sensor. So it costs nearly nothing to make, and yet it can create a sensor that could be used for motion detection. It could register heart rate. It could register breathing. There are a lot of things that it could be used for sensing. The beauty of this is that it's extremely low cost. So if this new development works out, we may find that there'll be little bits of graphene floating around in our wearables very shortly. Head impacts continue to be a major concern for amateur and professional sports and other activities as well, such as construction workers and things like that. The fact is, head impacts can lead to traumatic brain injury, and traumatic brain injury turns out to be about a third of all injury deaths in the U.S. alone. Understanding more about concussions and being able to measure the effects of head impacts is getting increasingly important, and there's a lot of research being done on this. One of the ways that people assess the consequences of a head impact is they check the subject's balance. They use something called a balance accelerometer measurement. How well do you stand steady without falling over? And this is usually done by strapping some device to your waist. There's problems with it, and it can be inconvenient, but a bunch of researchers have tried using smart glasses, like the Google Glass, and take measurements about the subject's stability based on these head-mounted sensors rather than one attached to their waist. As it turns out, with a relatively small sample of subjects, they found that there was a high correlation between the measurements taken from the head as around the waist. These smart glasses may be much more convenient to use out in the field and could make it possible to detect the effects of a head impact much more easily and much faster than the traditional methods.
For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. Fake news, fake video, and fake sound. According to the BBC, the phrase fake news in record time morphed from a description of a social media phenomenon into a journalistic cliché and an angry political slur. How did the term evolve? It was the mid-2016, and BuzzFeed's media editor, Craig Silverman, noticed a funny stream of completely made-up stories that seemed to originate from one small Eastern European town. We ended up finding a small cluster of news websites all registered in the same town in Macedonia, Corvilius, Silverman recalls. He and a colleague started to investigate, and shortly before the U.S. election, they identified at least 140 fake news websites which were pulling in huge numbers on Facebook. The young people in Vilnius may or may not have much interest in American politics, but because of the money to be made via Facebook advertising, they wanted their fiction to travel widely on social media. And so the Macedonians and other purveyors of fakery wrote stories with headlines such as Pope Francis shocks world, endorses Donald Trump for president, and FBI agent suspected in Hillary email leaks, found dead in apparent murder-suicide. They were completely false, and thus began the modern and internet-friendly life of the phrase fake news. Misinformation, spin, lies, and deceit have, of course, been around forever. But what Silverman and others uncovered was a unique marriage between social media algorithms, advertising systems, people prepared to make stuff up to earn some easy cash, and an election that gripped the nation for much of the world. What is fake news and what is real news? There are three major websites that many use to do fact-checking. There's truthorfiction.org, Snopes.com, and factcheck.org. Truthorfiction.com, also truthorfiction.org, is a myth-busting website about urban legends, internet rumors, e-rumors, email forwards, and other questionable pictures or stories. The topics are researched by Truth or Fiction staff and rated truth, if true, or fiction, if untrue. When the accuracy is not known with certainty, the stories are rated unproven, disputed, reported to be truth or reported to be fiction. Partially true stories are rated truth and fiction. Truth, but inaccurate details or similar. Snopes.com, formerly known as Urban Legends Reference Pages, is one of the first online fact-checking websites. It is a widely known resource for validating and debunking urban legends and similar stories in American popular culture. Factchecking.org is a nonprofit, nonpartisan website that describes itself as a consumer advocate for voters that aims to reduce the level of deception and confusion in U.S. politics. Most of its contents consists of rebuttals to what it considers inaccurate, misleading, or false claims made by politicians. Factcheck.org has also targeted misleading claims from various partisan groups. Hey, Joe, what say you about, well, fake news?
You know, Hank, when we talk about fake news, up till now, we were talking about news that we didn't like, that something we didn't agree with, that was something that was said against us. That came out of Washington, that concept of fake news. But then we found out that the Russians were very anxious to prevent certain political actions in this country, and so they loaded our social media with truly fake news, things that they made up about Hillary Clinton and other people running for office. And they eventually, what they were trying to do was to convert our free election into something more fixed so that somebody that they approved of would get elected president. And indeed, they were successful. But now I'm on the front page of the New York Times and elsewhere, I've seen stories that, well, they're so frightening, Hank, because they're giving us scientific, artificial intelligence ways of really creating fake news. They're able to pretty totally imitate a voice, and even worse, they've been able to Photoshop a picture onto somebody while they're faking the voice of that person. In other words, they're creating fake news. And with what I now know about the people who vote in this country, I am very, very frightened. I'm frightened for the American experiment in democracy. I'm frightened for the world at large. I think we've really just opened up Pandora's box, and it'll never be able to be closed again.
As reported in the New York Times last week, artificial intelligence video tools are now readily available to make it relatively easy to put one person's face on another person's body with few traces of manipulation. This is called fake videos or deep fakes. An ultra-realistic fake video can be made with artificial intelligence software. The program is called Fake App or Fake APP, and it can superimpose the face of a public figure onto a body of a pornographic actor or actress. If you didn't know better, you might have thought it was real. Until recently, realistic computer-generated video was a laborious pursuit available only to big-budget Hollywood productions or cutting-edge researchers. Social media apps like Snapchat include some rudimentary face-morphing technology. But in recent months, a community of hobbyists has begun experimenting with more powerful tools, including Fake App, a program that was built by an anonymous developer using open-source software written by Google. Fake Apps makes it free and relatively easy to create realistic face swaps and leave few traces of manipulation. Since a version of the app appeared on Reddit in January, it has been downloaded more than 120,000 times. Deepfakes are one of the newest forms of digital media manipulations and one of the most obviously mischief-prone. Reddit closed a handful of deepfakes groups, including one with nearly 100,000 members. Before the Reddit deepfakes groups were closed, they hosted a mixture of users trading video editing tips and showing off their latest forgeries. The deepfakes creator community is now in the internet shadows, but while out in the open, it gave an unsettling peek into the future. Fake App uses a suite of machine learning tools called TensorFlow, which was developed by Google's Artificial Intelligence Division and released to the public in 2015. The software teaches itself to perform image recognition tasks through trial and error, and the more powerful the processing on hand, the faster it works. In time, artificial intelligence is going to make it easier than ever to fake images and video. Artificial intelligence is making human speech as malleable and replicable as pixels. Today, a Canadian artificial intelligence startup named Lyrebird, that's L-Y-R-E-B-I-R-D, unveiled its first product, a set of algorithms the company claims can clone anyone's voice by listening to just a single minute of sample audio. A few years ago, this would have been impossible, but the analytical prowess of machine learning has proven to be a perfect fit for idiosyncrasies of human speech. Using artificial intelligence, companies like Google has been able to create incredibly lifelike synthesized voices. Adobe has unveiled its own prototype software called Project Voco that can edit human speech like Photoshop tweaks digital images. Project Voco, that's V-O-C-O, requires at least 20 minutes of sample audio before it can mimic a voice. Lyrebird, on the other hand, cuts this requirement down to just 60 seconds. Lyrebird says its algorithm can infuse the speech it creates with emotion, letting customers make voices sound angry, sympathetic, or stressed out. The resulting speech can be put to a wide range of uses, says Lyrebird, including reading of audiobooks with famous voices. Lyrebird's founders, which originally was founded by three university students from the University of Montreal, acknowledge that their technology raises important societal issues, including bringing into question the veracity of audio recordings used in court. For now, Lyrebird's tech is still in development. Lyrebird is working to improve its algorithm, including adding support for different languages like French. People are now aware that photos can be faked. I think in the future, audio recordings are going to become less and less reliable as evidence. People still fall for convincing fakes in the right context, and the same would be true of voice synthesis. With fake news, fake video, fake audio, is there anything we can do about it? Can you spot a fake video? Is there any way you can identify a fake video? If, as it's most likely, the video purports to be on YouTube, Vimeo, or one of the other big online streaming services, make sure that's where you are by checking the location in the address bar of your browser. And don't allow any link or attachment to install what it claims to be special viewer or update that it says you need before you can watch. That's almost certainly malware. Well, there's a couple ways of spotting fake videos. First, always raise a skeptical eyebrow when you see anything that is out of the ordinary. A video that's blurred, lasts just a couple of seconds, or shot in poor light has a high chance of being a spoof. If the camera itself doesn't move, in other words, it's static, the chances are it's mounted on a tripod. Check the surroundings in the video frame. Are objects and people the right proportion to each other? Investigate where there's been any other previous authenticated real-world instances or report of a similar subject matter. If the subject is outdoors or it's in an illuminated room, check if the shadows are in the same direction as everything else. Is the outcome of the event consistent what it should be? Does the object resemble something else you've seen, perhaps shot from a different angle? Check any comments that are accompanied with the video. And finally, and perhaps most important, do an internet search using the name of the video file and the word hoax or fake. Even TV companies and other media have been successfully hoaxed. Just remember, we live in an era of advanced video technology where the camera can and increasingly does lie. The fake video is here to stay. Now, what about detecting edited audio? On all digital recordings, there's a background hum. Even if the hum is picked up at a very low level that you can't hear, we can extract this information. This is a technique known as electric network frequency analysis, and it is helping forensic scientists to separate genuine, unedited recordings from those that have been tampered with. They can extract the hum and compare it with the total recording itself. If it is a continuous recording, it will all match up nicely. If there are some breaks in the recording, or if it's been stopped or started, the profiles won't match, or there will be a section missing. Or if it has come from two different recordings, look as if there's one, then we have two different profiles with that one not matching.
Sure, our cybernetic house has a lot of tricks up its sleeves, but it also has a lot of fundamental work to do to keep its promise of dodging major maintenance or repairs for 40 years and of being energy miserly. I also made a promise in my segment on the CAP, our ceiling awareness pod. I made you some information and explanation promises I'd like to start keeping. To recap the CAP, there are 30 of them in the house. Each one located in the middle of a ceiling in a room or down a hallway in a familiar, nondescript, two-gang electrical box. You might have switches or outlets in these electrical boxes at your place. We have mostly plain cover plates over them, so they're there to not be noticed. One of the most important things happening up there, one of several things, but one of the most important, is that 10 times every second, each one of them is taking 64 total temperature measurements of the space below it. That's 8 across and 8 down, and obviously an 8x8 grid. at 9 feet at the ceiling. That means at the floor level, each side of each of those grid cells is about 2 feet. The grids are about 2 feet square. Now, with 30 of these caps, each taking 64 measurements, that's almost 2,000 temperature readings, 2,000 of these 2x2 cells being read across the entire house. When you put them together, that's a moderately detailed temperature map of the house. Is that really useful? With luck, by the time I'm done today, you won't be asking that anymore. You might think of each of these 8x8 scans like a really coarse, really low-resolution camera. I do. And that leads to a term you may not normally hear. Fixels. Like thermal pixels. Put those together, fixels. Think of them as being just a little brighter every time the temperature reading is just a little higher. So here are these couple of thousand temperature readings updated 10 times every second. Why so fast? Well, think about this. Roughly, what's the temperature of the room you're in right now? And if you cross the room, does that change very much? Background temperature changes, which we'll talk about more in just a minute, background temperature changes tend to be slow, especially indoors. Let's think about the 2 foot square that you're in right now. It's going to read something closer, not to the background temperature, but to 99 degrees. 98.6 sound like a number it might hit? 99 degrees until you move. Now, how fast will you move? Well, the sensor we use gives us just two options, reading once per second or reading 10 times per second. Let's stick in a little math. If you're the fastest guy around and you can run a 4-minute mile, that's 15 miles an hour, and 15 miles an hour is 22 feet per second, meaning if we're waiting a second to take the next measurement, you could be 22 feet away, so you're not that fast. Maybe you're 5 or 10 feet away. It means we've missed turning on the lights for you in the next place you're going. But at 10 times a second, every tenth of a second, you can't move much more than 2.2 feet. A foot, foot and a half is more likely. That's about one thixel. So why do we care about that? Is the house spying on you? Well, not quite. Mostly, as I said, the house is trying to anticipate your needs, turning on lights as you approach places where you'll need light, turning off lights as you leave places, and so on. Tracking adults, children, infants, or pets, including those adult, children, infant, pet classifications, if we can, that all falls under the heading of warm body tracking. It's something hotels do, for example. So after you've been out of the hotel room for a while, the TV turns off, turns itself off. The thermostat relaxes. Maybe the housekeeping staff gets an alert. I mention hotels because they exemplify a classic category of identifying the occupancy or vacancy of accessible spaces. If there's somebody there, it's occupied. If there's nobody there, it's vacant. Occupancy, vacancy. That's a term that may come up in automation more as you get more into it. Occupancy, vacancy. Now, a lot of that in hotels gets done by passive infrared, or PIR, P-I-R. PIR detectors are relatively inexpensive, and they trigger on motion, not just warm body presence. If you've ever been in a conference room and they had the lights turn off because nobody was moving very much, that's why. Because they use PIR sensors. We're not. We're using active sensors based on some very sophisticated MEMS microelectronics. Remember, that sensor is connected to the Raspberry Pi in each cap ceiling pod. One-on-one relationship. One of those sensors, one Raspberry Pi. So we can do some processing right on the spot. And the first part of that processing is a simple temperature threshold. Above some reasonable level, maybe 88 degrees. That reasonable level sets what we might expect to be less than the temperature of a warm body, but more than a background temperature for a room. So we'll try 88 degrees. We might try some others, but 88 degrees for discussion right now. We can assume if it's warmer than that, we're seeing a warm body. If it's cooler than that, it's a background temperature. Background temperature, not a trivial thing. And there are some warmer readings we know to ignore. For example, if that particular location, that thixel, the one being read, happens to be the location of a stovetop burner or a fireplace. And we can analyze the data to try to characterize whether what we're seeing, what we're reading, is an adult or a child or an infant or a pet. Or even, think about this, a hotspot, whether it's something less worrisome like candles or more worrisome like if the bed is on fire. And hey, those temperature measurements are able to catch some kinds of fires before smoke or CO alarms. How hot is your dog? Is your dog more than 120 degrees, more than 130, more than 140? Those are temperatures at which the beginnings of a fire can be detected before those other usual fire detection systems kick in. Doesn't matter. We still use the others. One thing the house can do when there is a fire, and this is one of its tricks, and I'm proud of this. There's a panel at the front door that is normally just a vanity panel that just shows the street address. But if it detects a fire, if the house detects a fire, that changes into a real-time map of the floor plan of the house, indicating on its face the location of every adult, child, infant, pet, or hotspot on the floor plan. House does some other things, unlocking doors, calling the fire department, turning off fans, a lot of other stuff. While we're at it, if the house catches fire or has another emergency when nobody is home, when there are no warm body measurements, a quick query of the house-wide warm body tracking can confirm that in milliseconds. And that's information that the house can selectively include in its automated voice call to 911. Automated. Yes, we have one of the last voice modems. So far, you're up on the idea of 10 scans every second, of a temperature map of the whole house in almost 2,000 two-foot squares, and on some of the ways we can use information about warm bodies. But what about those background temperatures? That's really where I wanted to put our attention today. But first, I wanted to make sure you have at least some understanding of how we're collecting our thermal map data and why we're doing it so often and in a lot more places than anybody else. Really, how many places does your house take its own temperature? Okay, in a thermostat or two, maybe, but where else? Usually nowhere. When we isolate warm body locations in a room or a hallway, we don't throw away those other readings. Well, maybe a few. You're not going to be perfectly inside the 2 foot square of one single thixel. So we may choose to ignore the surrounding thixels because your warm body may influence their readings. But out of 64 thixels in the room, that still leaves a lot of usable readings. So in the Raspberry Pi's processing of the data as each scan comes in, we build an array of the readings that include those background temperature readings. We figure out which ones to ignore and deal with the rest. We look for the highest background temperature reading, the lowest reading, and the average reading. We look for too big of a difference between the highest background reading and the lowest. What if you're in a room that's 60 degrees on one side and 90 on the other? That could be a sign of trouble. Now think about it. What could make that happen? A broken window? Something wrong with the insulation? Something wrong with the ventilation? Neighbor on fire? Or maybe it's just warmer and cooler pockets in the room. We can test for that. If there's too wide a spread of background temperatures in the room and there's a ceiling fan in the room, the automation can turn on the ceiling fan to stir the air. If that doesn't reduce the temperature spread in, 20 or 30 minutes, it's a bigger problem. In our system, that means an email message goes to the resident reporting what the system sees, suggesting things to look for, and providing some helpful information. Most of the time, there should not be that much of a spread within a room. But what about that whole room average? Should we apply it across the house? Not exactly. I mentioned keeping track of occupancy versus vacancy. Does your house have any unused bedrooms? Have you thought about what it might be costing you to keep those at the same temperature as the rest of the house? Our comfort system, among other things, adjusts the airflow into each room. Each duct at the register has a device in it to control how much air can flow through. Kind of an air valve, we'll call it that for now. It's in the duct just before the register. So with a little programming, we can relax the thermostat for each room one at a time by controlling that airflow. If that room's vacant and the door is closed, and if the door isn't closed, it's going to share with the house whether we want it to or not. So if it's vacant and the door is closed, that room is allowed to get a little warmer or a little cooler than the rest of the house, and that reduces the amount of demand on the HVAC system, and an energy saving now and a life expectancy increase by providing less wear and tear on the equipment. If you think of the whole house ventilation system as a musical instrument, it tunes each room to its own needs while maintaining harmony across the house. By the way, that means about 30% in energy savings by comparison to classic HVAC systems. Those room-by-room background temperature averages, provide extremely useful information to the comfort control logic and the analyses we do. I hope all of this info, and you've gone through a lot with me, I hope all this info means I kept my promise to explain why background temperature measurements are a good thing. I still have a few more promises to keep, but until next time, promise us this, that you'll back up, back up, back up. Hank?
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Reminder that Daylight Savings Time starts on the second Sunday in March, which is this coming Sunday, with exceptions being Arizona, except for the Navajo, who do observe Daylight Savings Time on tribal lands, Hawaii and the overseas territories of American Samoa, Guam, the Northern Mariana Islands, Puerto Rico, and the United States Virgin Islands. Daylight Savings Time lasts for about a total of 34 weeks. That's 238 days every year, about two-thirds of the entire year. The New York Amateur Computer Club has a meeting on Thursday, March 8th. Presentation is a free alternative to Microsoft Windows 10. Meeting place is NYU Silver Building, room 405 or 405 in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group will be meeting on Friday, March 9th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the New York Institute of Technology at Old Westbury Campus, Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, Auditorium of the Harry J. Schur Hall. Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on must-have utilities for your computer. Thursday, March the 22nd, 6:45 p.m. is the starting time of the meeting at the Middletown Library Large Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road, Middletown, New Jersey. Princeton PCs Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, March the 27th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society will be meeting Tuesday, April 3rd. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on different categories of artificial intelligence. Thursday, April 5th, meeting time 7 p.m. at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road, on the first floor in White Plains, New York. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will be meeting on Friday, April the 6th with a presentation on home automation. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains. The meetings at the computer clubs are all free and open to the public, and we hope to see you there. And TCF 2018 is March the 17th, Saturday. It is a computer festival featuring talks, workshops, and vendors. The theme of the festival this year is wearable technologies. It will be held at the College of New Jersey from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. For more information, the website is tcf-nj.org. The keynote speaker is Dr. Nick Van Terheden. Dr. Nick is a leader in digital healthcare and innovation and former chief medical officer for Dell. The feature speaker is George Harris with a presentation on medical tricorders, taking science fiction into reality. I hope to be seeing you at the festival. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio or WBAI.org streaming on the internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and remember, backup is very essential, so just back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week. Reminder that Daylight Savings Time starts on the second Sunday in March, which is this coming Sunday.